In today's election, we see all the candidates talking openly about religion. What to say about all of this? It seems as though people are still voting with their religious hearts, but that there has been a move to try and tame something that seems to have spun a little bit out of control.
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. In about a week, the Miller Center of Public Affairs, along with our partners McNeil Lehrer Productions, will present the third in our series of major policy debates. The topic that we're going to be debating is the place of religion in the public square. And in fact, the formal resolution that we will be debating is religion has no place in politics or government. Speaking in favor of this resolution will be Reverend Barry Lynn and Jacques Berlinerblau, and arguing against will be Chuck Colson and Bishop Harry Jackson. In preparing for these debates, we've asked our friend Isabel Kennard to prepare a white paper, which will be posted on our website tomorrow, and to present a Miller Center forum describing the historical context and the present contours of this great debate. Isabel Kennard is a cum laude graduate of the University of Chicago and earned her law degree at DePaul College of Law. After practicing in law for 5 years, she did the intelligent thing. She began graduate school at the University of Chicago Divinity School. In 2001, she received her PhD in church history. She's taught in the Department of Religious Studies at the College of William and Mary and is now the vice president of the Council for America's First Freedom in Richmond. Thank you very much. Please welcome Isabel Kennard.
Thank you, George. Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for coming here. Thank you to the Miller Center for hosting me. It's a pleasure to be here to talk about my favorite topic, religion and politics. I've always been a little bit of an outlier on these kinds of things. When I was a teenager, you know, I was a rebel without a cause. Then, you know, as a college student, I just used bad language to shock people. Now I've got something even better that people never want to talk about, religion and politics. So on I go about it whenever I'm given the chance. Today, I want to set out for you some of the developments, particularly over the last 50 years in religion and politics, in order to introduce to you some of the issues that might come up in this debate, and in order to get you to start, maybe you've already thought a lot about this, but to think about the questions here, because it's you who need to decide where we're going to go from here in terms of religion and politics. It's a critical issue in this year's election, certainly, and it's also critical in our public policy these days. So in order to sketch that out, I'm going to cover four basic areas. The colonial historical roots of this relationship. That's because so many public figures today cite colonial history in order to say, this is where we should be. So let's have a quick look at that. The legal and legislative picture for the relation of church and state, basically. The rising influence of a conservative religious and political voice in public policy that we've seen in our country since 1980. And finally, I will sketch out the changes in presidential and party politics that have occurred perhaps as a response to, or perhaps as a culmination of these changes. So, religion in the public square and early American history. The myth here, or the myths that I hear most often, is that we are a Christian nation. The other great myth that I hear all the time is that there is a single founding intent. When you go to the issue of religion and politics at the founding, you find anything but a single founding intent, and really not much of a Christian nation as a whole. The reason for this is that in early America, there was really quite a religiously diverse population. Christopher Columbus, as you probably have thought about sometimes, was, of course, a Catholic. Large parts of our continent were settled by Catholics. Florida and Canada, principally settled by Spanish and French empires. Also in this region, we have Native Americans and very, very old settlements of Jewish communities. In New England, though, you can see some differences in terms of the regions of the country. If we look at the three basic regions, New England, the Mid-Atlantic states, and then the South, I can make some generalizations. In New England, the myth there is that the pilgrims came here for religious freedom, and so they brought religious freedom into law. Well, the pilgrims, sad to say, didn't really last that long, and they were soon replaced by the Puritans, who were not the revolutionaries that the pilgrims were, or revolutionaries is perhaps an overstatement. At any rate, the Puritans were extremely intolerant of any kind of religious diversity. We've all heard all about how that went. And living up to the traditions that they had brought with them, they established their religion in their new colonies. The religion that they established, Puritanism, is also known as Congregationalism. Congregationalism was the established religion of Massachusetts well into the 1830s of this country. So you've got a very homogeneous culture there. There's some talk of toleration. There's talk of freedom of conscience. Aside from Rhode Island, in most of New England, you've got a fairly homogeneous population that is, on the whole, relatively intolerant of differences. The most sort of hardcore Puritans are in Massachusetts, of course. In the Mid-Atlantic colonies, they too, the settlers to the Mid-Atlantic colonies, also brought with them a tradition of having an established church, and so each colony would establish its church. But the immigration to these colonies really ended up building a kind of de facto pluralism or religious diversity that forced the Mid-Atlantic regions to practice toleration of religious differences, even within the context of having certain established churches. In the South, you've got a highly Anglican population in early America. Virginia, for instance, Church of England is established from the get-go. It's established as part of the colonial British Empire. During the 1740s, you have the Great Awakening, and there are these religious revivalists coming down to Virginia and converting people to religions other than Anglicanism. We call that group of people who no longer are part of the established church, dissenters. The dissenters is just a name for people who were Baptists, who were Methodists, who were Quakers and Presbyterians. They were very brutally, well, harshly suppressed in colonial Virginia. You had to have a license to preach. Generally, only Anglican ministers could get a license to preach. Some Presbyterian ministers were able to obtain one. A number of Baptist ministers, however, were thrown into jail in Chesterfield County, for instance. So after the Revolution comes, you've got Madison and Jefferson kind of leading things in Virginia, and they're looking at this situation where there's a lot of tension really coming from the ground over issues of religious diversity. There are more and more Baptists by the day, and Jefferson and Madison are also very influenced by Enlightenment philosophy, talks about the rights of man, the light of reason, all of those things that you've heard associated with Enlightenment philosophy. So what happens is kind of a compromise between an idea coming down from above that is essentially man was born free and has the right to make his decisions about his religion. I keep saying his, by the way, because that's the way they thought about it at the time. So even though that's not the case any longer, we're talking about colonial Virginia. The other thing that's happening is that you've got really thousands of people who no longer belong to that established church who are saying, hey, we want our freedom. We want to be able to have our preachers. We want to have our churches. We don't want to be punished for this. In colonial Virginia, you couldn't hold public office if you didn't belong to the established church. You couldn't get married except in the established church. There were lots of things that you couldn't do if you didn't belong to the established church. So there's lots of problems. Well, after the revolution, the Church of England starts looking not so great, right? It seems like it's part of that imperial arm of the British Empire. And so there's even more popular support for finding a way to get rid of this established church or to put, at least displace it. The solution that Madison and Jefferson reach is the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which grants everybody the right to freedom of conscience and the freedom to profess and to speak to other people about their own religion. This tradition of religious freedom is passed on or is taken by Madison and others to the first constitutional convention. And what does it produce but the First Amendment, which says, after the Articles of Confederation are gotten rid of, that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, at the Constitutional Convention, you're facing a situation where the framers are trying to create a union that's strong enough to withstand some of these tensions, yet isn't so oppressive of states' rights that it's going to fail necessarily. Religion was one of the forces of disunity that really could be pushed aside. People fought about religion. People fought between themselves about religion. One way to effect a union is to take questions of religion off the table. So you give everybody freedom of religion. There'll be no established federal religion, means all the states and all the people can do basically what they want. They're still Americans, though. They're still a part of this union. The interesting effect that this has is that it levels the playing field between religions so that they actually have to compete with one another for adherence. And that's one of the reasons why we still have, as a Western nation, probably the most vital and diverse religious culture. Because religion got really good at getting people to support it, or churches did. So anyway, the First Amendment comes about. It has two clauses. The first clause is that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That's called the Establishment Clause. The second clause is, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's the Free Exercise Clause. You might note that it says Congress, not public schools. You might also note that there's no language here of separation of church and state. That's something that comes from one of Jefferson's letters written during his 1800 campaign to the Danbury Baptists of Connecticut. He spoke to them of the wall of separation between church and state when he himself was being charges were being leveled against him, mostly in the press, saying, oh, you know, this guy is an atheist. He doesn't believe in God at all. He comes back. He writes to the Danbury Baptist. He said, no, I do believe in strong religious conviction, but there should be a strong wall of separation. So Let's move now to the legal picture. One of the myths that you see in the legal picture is the idea that the legal picture is all about definitions and it's absolutely clearly defined. Unfortunately, nothing could be less true than that. First of all, we have a First Amendment that starts with Congress shall make no law. Well, how did it get from Congress shall make no law to school teachers shall not make their kids recite prayers? That didn't happen in this country until the 1940s. Justice Black of the Supreme Court put forward his constitutional theory called the doctrine of incorporation, which brought many of the freedoms enumerated in the Bill of Rights to apply to state and local government. The basis, his technical basis for this, was he relied on the language of the 14th Amendment, which was written after the Civil War. And it stated that no state shall deprive any citizen of due process of, shall deprive any citizen of his freedoms without due process of law. Black looked at this and he said, you know, this idea of life, liberty, and property that's in the 14th Amendment is really a broader notion than just about slavery. And so he started to persuade his fellow justices to include other rights that had been enumerated in the Bill of Rights into this understanding of life, liberty, and property, particularly liberty. So it's as though the 14th Amendment was a needle, and if you can imagine, the rights in the Bill of Rights are like a thread that go through the eye of this liberty idea that's in the 14th Amendment, and Justice Black sews it into the legal fabric of the country in this way. So, in 1943, the Free Exercise Clause is held by the Supreme Court to apply to all state and local government. In 1947, the Establishment Clause is held to apply to state and local government. The interesting thing is that since that's happened, the Establishment Clause has been the place where there's been the most bitter litigation. Constant fighting over that. And another interesting aspect to this is that when Justice Black writes his opinion incorporating the Establishment Clause, what does he cite but Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist Association? So he takes something that's really quite outside of the constitutional framework and incorporates it into a line of Supreme Court opinions. And he writes to define establishment, neither state nor local nor federal nor the federal government can set up a church, neither can pass laws which aid one religion, aid all religions, or prefer one religion over another. Neither can force nor influence a person to go or to remain away from church against his will, or force him to profess a belief or disbelief in any religion. No persons can be punished for entertaining or professing religious beliefs or disbeliefs, for church attendance or non-attendance. No tax in any amount, large or small, can be levied to support any religious activities or institutions, whatever they may be called. Neither a state nor the federal government can openly or secretly participate in the affairs. And he cites Jefferson, the clause against establishment of religion by law was intended to, quote, erect a wall of separation between church and state. Now, this seems like it's a firm thing, and this is where this myth of everything is decided really comes up. People are often saying to me, well, it's the separation of church and state. Sandra Day O'Connor very wisely refers to this wall as a serpentine wall, because in fact, there are all kinds of ebbs and flows. In the schools, establishment is probably thought or construed most strictly by the courts. That's because school teachers are employed by the government. So when they're acting in their capacity of as teachers, they seem like they're speaking from the pulpit of the government. That's why they can't lead prayers, they can't read from the Bible. All of these things would seem to endorse religion. However, what's interesting is that the Supreme Court has recently allowed, in the last 10 years or so, vouchers to be used public school vouchers to be used for the support of religious schools. Now, doesn't that seem to you like that's tax dollars going to support churches? Well, in that case, the Supreme Court has held that the intent of the law setting up school vouchers was neutral, even though the effect may have been to support or promote religion, and therefore they allowed it, looking just at the neutral intent of the law. That's a pretty loose standard. Since that time, we also have the White House Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, where federal tax dollars are being used by the White House to fund faith-based organizations under a series of pretty strict rules. But nonetheless, this has been upheld, essentially, by the Supreme Court, or so it looks. There's no taxpayer standing to challenge faith-based organizations. Public displays and monuments, you've got a really split scene on this. Sometimes Ten Commandment monuments are allowed under one reason, set of reasons, and sometimes they're not allowed. The Nebraska state legislature and all legislatures are allowed to open their sessions with a prayer. That's because of the, quote, unambiguous and unbroken history of more than 200 years that that is the practice of opening legislative sessions with a prayer. The free exercise clause has been less litigated. However, the courts have given really the least accommodation to free exercise. Essentially, the government, according to most Supreme Court cases, can impose quite a substantial burden on someone's practice of religion as long as it shows a rational basis for doing so. The last case in the line of this happened in 1990. It so outraged religious conservatives that since that time we've been working on legislative solutions to free exercise. Those have worked pretty well with even though the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was struck down, we've got the Workplace Religious Freedom Act coming up and the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act that sets a higher standard. There have been many other voices, many religious voices for a long time that have been active in having an effect on religious policy. In the 1970s, Jerry Falwell and Phyllis Schlafly took aim at the abortion issue. This really gave birth to a whole right-to-life movement, which has tried to overturn Roe v. Wade, as well as a number of other issues. Human embryonic stem cell research has been limited by conservatives who think that the beginning of life is something that should not be violated in any ways. It also has implication for lesbian and gay rights. The place where the right to life movement really failed or had the hardest time was in the Terri Schiavo case, where the right-to-lifers said, you know, we mustn't disconnect her. There came to be all kinds of federal legislation, extended court battles about this. This turned into a fiasco, I think, that really divided both the conservative bloc that had traditionally sponsored right-to-life issues and, of course, motivated the left. In religion, we have voices on the left. Cardinal Mahoney of Los Angeles has been active in abortion issues. And then we've had the political presidents. We've had the presidents also being influenced by these religious values. Presidents have been influenced by religious values since the get-go. Probably the most stunning statement of this, though, was with John F. Kennedy, who declared religion a private affair and essentially wanted to take it out of the public discourse. There was a real backlash against that from the same religious right. They coalesced into a voting bloc that helped bring Ronald Reagan into office. By 2000, they were really behind George Bush, and he himself was saying, you know, Christ is my favorite philosopher because he changed my heart. In the 2004 election, John Kerry is like the bad guy because his bishop is openly sanctioning him for his stance on abortion. So it looks like the right is all about religion and the left is not about religion. In today's election, that has certainly changed. We see all the candidates talking openly about religion. Romney on the right has talked about his religion, which is Mormonism. That's quite a change of pace for us. And all of the Democratic candidates have participated in a forum to talk about their faith commitments. Nonetheless, a recent Pew Forum shows that 61% of Americans would be less likely to vote for a candidate who does not believe in God. 45% say they would be reluctant to vote for a Mormon. For a Muslim. Evangelicals have more reservations about voting for a Mormon than they would about a Christian. What to say about all of this? It seems as though people are still voting with their religious hearts, but that there has been a move to try and tame something that seems to have spun a little bit out of control. In conclusion, I want to just turn to Mark Lilla's recent work, The Stillborn God, where he talks about the separation of church and state and its intellectual heritage. Now, in my dream life, I would be the one who organizes the books at Barnes & Noble, and I would put Mark Lilla in the self-help section under something called Finding Your Inner Nerd. he writes, success has bred complacency. The success is real. Contemporary liberal democracies have managed to accommodate religion without setting off sectarian violence and theocracy, but accommodation is not understanding. He talks then about how fragile this success, the balance of church and state, is, and how closely tied it is to the unique experience that he sees within Protestant sectarian culture. The question then that faces us now is, how do we retain this fragile balance? Where do we go from here? And how do we want to play itself out in the future? And that's something our debate will address. Thank you, George.
I'm going to move to the back of the room, and I invite those who have questions to queue up in the back of the room with me, and we should have plenty of time to handle a number of questions. But as I walk to the back, Isabel, I'd like to ask you to perhaps talk a little bit more about one of your opening comments, and that was you set up as a myth the notion that the United States was formed as a so-called Christian nation, and yet each of the religious groups that you mentioned in connection with the founding was some aspect, some brand of Christianity. Why do you think that those who really are looking at what the founders did should not talk of it as, at least initially, a Christian nation?
Well, I think you can certainly see majority Christian, Protestant population, absolutely. But religious diversity has existed in this country from the get-go and has always been a source of tension, whether that most of that religious diversity has existed amongst Protestants. But there have been, as I said, Jews and Catholics here from the beginning, as well as indigenous religions. The founders, if you look at what Jefferson and Madison say, Jefferson, for instance, says, "It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my back. If my neighbor is a Muslim, a Hindu, or a Jew." So I think that Jefferson understood that there was a possibility of having a truly diverse nation out there. Also, the founders have a deep commitment to protecting the rights of minorities. That's another factor that I would cite. And finally, I would cite Madison's letter in Federalist 10, where he talks about the importance of eliminating factions in control of government. He's, of course, talking about this in terms of establishing a federal kind of a government, but he mentions religion amongst the possible factions. So I think that Madison there clearly sees religion as something that leads to disunity rather than unity. So even though there may be a de facto majority of a particular kind, I don't think any of the founders wanted that to be the national flavor.
I'd like to push a little bit more on the way the evangelical movements are moving today. I think in the popular mind that evangelicals are all embracing so-called conservative causes, questions of personal morality, and so on. And yet many of the leading evangelicals today seem to be adding to their list of concerns issues of worldwide poverty, the AIDS epidemic, environmental issues, fouling the environment. Where do you see the public discourse among evangelicals heading?
Well, I think that the evangelicals, that term has always been a term that is overly ironing out real differences that exist within that branch. Certainly evangelical Christians have been motivated, moved, organized into a voting bloc. That does not mean that all differences of opinions have been erased in there. You cite quite aptly the fact that there's been a real split in terms of evangelical endorsements of candidates. So, for instance, Pat Robertson endorsed Giuliani at one point, John McCain talked about wanting to be or thinking of himself as a Southern Baptist who was planning to go through full immersion baptism at one point. We've got a whole spectrum of things going on there. Yes, Richard Cizik, who is the president of the National Association of Evangelicals, has gone way out on a limb to say, really what we need to be focusing on is the earth that God gave us. And so we need to be focused on environmental issues and on care for the poor. The Southern Baptist Church was second only to the American Red Cross in providing faith-based, actually, White House-funded faith-based assistance after Hurricane Katrina. So you're seeing a questioning of this. Is it really just the family issues that are going to be the only thing that matter to us and that we're going to lobby on, or can we, in fact, look at a broader spectrum of issues? I think that Obama is doing a very good job to reaching out to many religious voters, and some of those traditional family values voters are finding him a very appealing candidate, too.
What I find is that there is a very difficult and ambiguous status for atheism, because there is no space for it. Addressing every faith means that no religion, not no faith, because I don't think the two are similar, is unthinkable, or that. And I am new to this country, and this is a surprise.
Well, you must be from Europe, is what I can say with certainty, because the Europeans really are ahead of us on this. And this is something that I've actually just recently been discussing with some lawyers that I'm working on to develop a joint statement on religion in the public square, where we talked about using the phrase, people of all faiths or none. And it was pointed out that to say people of all faiths or none is not as inclusive as the European style of saying people of religion and belief. There's still a great deal of resistance within our legal community to saying belief. It seems like it might open the door too wide to any kind of a thing. The Supreme Court has held that atheists have the same rights of belief that believers do, certainly in schools. They can't be forced to pledge allegiance to the flag. They can't be forced to pray. But when it comes to conscientious objectors, for instance, it's very hard in this country to get a conscientious objector status if you're an atheist. And so I think that we still have a way to go in terms of accepting or including belief as as part of the language by which we talk about non-believers or non-religious people. I say all the time, it's not really non-believers. It's not as though atheists have no beliefs. They just believe in other things. So I think that probably we will drift in the direction, according to the European model, which talks about religion and belief, but that's still a ways off. So,
good morning. In reading the debate question, I wonder if there is a fundamental flaw in the question as written, and I think it says, religion should have no place in politics or government. Now, my idea of politics is a much broader, more complex set of activities and pursuits. And to eliminate religion from politics would require an unbelievable degree of control over what people say, think, how they express themselves, how they communicate. Government, to me, is a very clear-cut activity. What do you think about that? Is there a difference between separating religion from politics and separating it from government?
I would agree entirely with you. I think that our politicians have a long history of using religious language. For instance, in his second inaugural, Lincoln is quoted as saying, "Both sides read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not that we be not judged. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes." Now, this is coming from a man who's not known to be a very religious man. When he's asked about the afterlife, he flat out says, "I don't believe in it." So what's he doing using this religious language? Well, it turns out in his case, I think what he's doing is trying to give a vocabulary to politics so that they can talk about, so that people can talk about fundamental values. And as you point out, as you rightly point out, religion is one of the things that we just can't get around when we're talking within our culture and about politics. In governance, absolutely. Once you put the hat on of, you know, being a state employee or a government employee, there are different kinds of responsibilities that fall upon you. I think it's going to be a tough debate question. I think the real debate is going to be how much is too much and how much is, not enough.
Some of the more difficult issues arise when disestablishment comes into conflict with free exercise. And recently that has arisen in the case of, a student at a public school who is asked to give a baccalaureate address of some sort, and that person begins to proselytize and preach a certain particular religious perspective. What do you see as the direction that we're taking with that kind of conflict between free exercise and disestablishment?
Well, you've hit the nail right on the head with what's the controversy that's coming up. And in the case where a rabbi came to a graduation ceremony and launched into sectarian religious speech, that was held by the Supreme Court to be an unconstitutional establishment of religion. But as you say, when it comes to students, you do have that free exercise concern. Right now, the government would just have to show a rational basis to limit that student's speech, or to show that its limitation was neutral, had a neutral purpose, and was reasonable in terms of its time, place, and manner, like any other restriction on student free speech would be. There is, however, all kinds of legislation pending, and I don't know what the answer is going to be. We have a new Supreme Court. We don't know them too well. We know that five of the justices are Catholic. There certainly seems to be a majority conservative. On the other hand, they don't seem to be have been granting new rights where they didn't exist before. So states have been pretty successful in legislating on these things. I'm afraid I can't see into the future to tell you what's going to happen there, but I do think that you're right in pointing out the issue or the potential problem that will arise when a student goes up to give a valedictory address that he or she wants to be very religious in nature.
Perhaps my question will act as a bit of a follow-up. We spoke earlier about Europe, and it seems to me that a difference between how we've approached questions of religion and how Europe does it is that we concern ourselves mainly with freedom, and in Europe they place some value on specifically the absence of religion from any sort of public discourse and kind of a secular approach to these issues, such as, you know, the French headscarf law or the Turkish headscarf law, which has been making news recently. Do you see us tending in that direction, or will America maintain kind of its own unique approach to this issue?
I don't see us tending in that direction. I think that you have properly identified France as the example of greatest secularism. I think that many people look at the situation in France and the headscarf law and say to themselves, this seems to be really a violation of free exercise, that there's such a heightened awareness of maintaining the appearance of secularity at all times and in all places, that it seems to be treading on the rights of individuals. If you look at England, though, which is a different kind of a case, you still have an Archbishop of Canterbury who's head of the Church of England. You still have an established church in England. There are a number of European countries that do still have established religions. Scotland has an established church, too. And I think Denmark does, although they may have done away with it. Of course, Greece also has an established church and are thinking of doing away with that. So it's hard to lump all of Europe into one identifiable mold. The Turks have recently, under the leadership of Prime Minister Gül, brought about a new law that would allow students to wear their headscarves at least to university. And it seems that in a world where we want to embrace pluralism and diversity, where we regard that as something that is good for society, which seems to be a trend, at least at this point, that we also have to understand that that's going to require some accommodation. And so accommodation really, it's about free expression, it's about individual liberty, and not having a very strict kind of sectarianism. Secularism. That said, there's no telling what the future will bring. You know, we've swung all over the place on this one, and let's hope we're going to be around long enough to swing a few more times. So, can't tell you exactly how it's going to go. But I think radical sectarianism is not in our future.
Yeah, speaking of the Archbishop of Canterbury, recently he stated that it was inevitable that British culture accommodate the Muslim legal system because the differential in the birth rates in Muslim and non-Muslim populations. Do you think that's something that will happen?
Given the backlash, I think that that's It's highly unlikely that British legal codes would carve out a special set of laws for Muslims, although in other countries where there are far more equal representation to different religious sects, many times the solution is to have different laws for different religious groups. This is the case in Malaysia, certainly, for better or for worse. Is that something that's going to happen to Western Europe? I don't think it's going to happen anytime really soon. In terms of the formal writing of Sharia provisions into British law codes, but I think that there might be something that would come into the back door by way of, say, cultural considerations being an influence in particular court judgments.
When the income tax was established, where they established along with it various deductions that included money given to religious institutions.
I'm not quite understanding your...
You can deduct your...
For charitable contributions?
As a charitable deduction, it can be money given to a church.
Absolutely, right. Well, churches are entitled to 501c3 status as charitable organizations, as are other non-religious and charitable organizations. I think that the basis for this is to say that we're not going to have laws that either... that give special treatment, favorable treatment to religion, nor unfavorable treatment to religion. So are you a charitable organization? Well, if the Helping Hands or the local soup kitchen gets to be a charitable organization that's not church-based, it would seem unfair to deny that to a religious organization. What's happening most recently, though, in this 501c3 area is that you have churches endorsing political candidates. And this is where the IRS is really stepping in and saying, we're going to revoke this status because you are engaging in political activities. So that 501c3 status is also contingent upon not taking strong partisan positions or trying to, work your membership up to vote or lobby in a particular way.
In drawing the distinction between intent and effect, in pushing money toward faith-based initiatives, what is the legal basis for that, and is it not a kind of slippery slope?
It certainly is a slippery slope. There's three tests out there right now. The Lemon test for establishing religion looks not just at the neutral purpose, but also at the effect. However, this is a test that's being used less and less in our conservative Supreme Court. And increasingly, there's been an emphasis on just having something that's neutral in its intent. Some people say that's what's coming. The lay of the land right now, though, is it really depends on the particular fact situation. So, for instance, in a school where you have lots of very influenceable little kids, the courts tend to look most seriously at these establishment questions and to apply the strictest test in evaluating those questions. In other places, school vouchers is one such case where it's really the parents' choice that's diverting the money aside to what turns out to be religious institutions, but the law itself is neutral on its face, then the courts are upholding that. What seems to be happening more than anything else is that we seem to become, that increasingly there are very few clear rules of thumb. And increasingly, it seems like if you really have a question, you have to take it to court. The perfect example of this is the Ten Commandments monuments cases, one that went one way, one that went the other way. Is there a clear answer on what test you use to establish whether there's been an establishment of religion or not? No. So what are you going to do when you really have that question? Well, you've got very little choice if it differs from the absolute specifics of those two cases other than to take it to court. That's something that we probably as a society really need to address, because I don't think we want to, you know, have courts deciding every little issue that comes up, every Christmas display, every everything. So that's an area that needs more development and more clarity.
Thank you so much for a really informative talk. I have a multiple item question. First of all, I personally am totally against religion in school. As a public school teacher back in the late 50s, students wanted to start the day with the reciting of the Lord's Prayer. That wasn't too bad, but when it became preaching, and some of those students could really preach, I put a stop to that. I said, we'll just do the Lord's Prayer. But I come from Lebanon, where religion is, the country is based on religion. And that's why I'm totally against religion being in government and government being in religion. And I admire Thomas Jefferson and his separation of church from state. And I like your comment on, you know, you mentioned earlier the valedictorian or salutatorian who wanted to preach, and they said no, she couldn't preach, and I'm all for that. As a person who knows Islam, and I hear the constant bickering about Islam is going to take over, but there are approximately 10 million Muslims in this country who are and a population that is growing, and yet they only have one representative in Congress who happened to be Muslim. As a Christian, as an Episcopalian, my Lord's Prayer is different than a Catholic's Lord's Prayer, which is different than a Baptist Lord's Prayer. And there is a God who a lot of people call by different names, but they still believe in a God, in one God. Or they don't believe in any God. I think I spoke too long, but if you can comment on all of those, thank you.
I hope that I can offer some responsive commentary. Certainly, in the case of many Islamic countries, I think the situation there is that you have a large majority of people of one religion. And that was the case for a long time in the United States. Since the 1950s, however, we've lived in an environment where we certainly have Protestant Catholics and Jews, and then since the immigration reform changes of 1969, an environment that has even more religious diversity within it. I think what has come with that is that we've thought of this new term, pluralism, to talk about something, to express something that we want in our society. It's a value that we aspire to, and that is a society that has many different faces within it. To have that kind of pluralism, which is a new term, just like, say, globalization or macroeconomics is. But to bring that about as a value in our society, we do need to accommodate, especially at the level of children, their expression of religion. What we have to make sure of is that their expression of religion is not an imposition on their classmates, is not an imposition on people of other religious beliefs. It's certainly a heavy charge. I think we're up to it, and I think that it will make us a stronger and better nation because of it.
Well, this is a much more specific question, I think. During a recent Republican debate, the candidates were asked whether or not they believed that every word in the Bible was literally true. And they all answered as best they can. But later, one of the talking heads said they should not have asked it. They said that the question was unconstitutional and that it shouldn't have been asked, and that they shouldn't have answered it. And I would like for you to comment on that.
Well, let me note that Tim Russert, in a Democratic debate, asked all of the candidates what their favorite Bible passage was. And they all responded with something. It wasn't always from the Bible, but it was it was not a, you know, it was Christian-ish. I find this shocking, but I think that there's a certain extent to which people are afraid of that evangelical voting bloc at this point and the power that it may have. I think that this election will show how powerful that bloc really is and whether it's around to last. Obviously, when the candidates are speaking before they're actually the nominees for president, they're speaking to their party members. So the Republican candidates who answered that question thought they were speaking to their party members. The Democratic candidates thought they were speaking to their party members. Certainly, nobody stood up for Jews, atheists, Muslims, or Hindus. But that's politics, and we've got to face it that at this point, you know, it's a majority that's going to elect the president into office, and that's what they're angling for, is those majority votes. I think that we as citizens need to speak up to say, this is not something that I'm going to tolerate. There's certainly no law that would prohibit candidates from answering that question or even from launching into a sermon if they feel like it. What we as citizens have the power to do is not vote for them.
I think the debate on the topic that's been discussed, the proper role of religion in the public square, will be lively and intense. And as they say, please check your local listings to see the time and place where it will be broadcast. Thank you very much for introducing the topic.
Thank you.